In today's quest, we are keeping up with the Merovingian tradition. Treachery is afoot. This is the quest for power. Welcome back to the Quest for Power, where we are ranking and reviewing all of the European monarchs from the early Middle Ages to World War I. We are your self-proclaimed lore masters, Scott and Michael, and we are going to be taking you on a quest to expand your knowledge and to discuss the history and lore of Europe. So today we're going to be uncovering the secrets of Childebert, first of his name, Kinslayer, Relic Hunter, King of Paris, King of Orléans, and co-king of Burgundy. So if you're looking for some more adventure and want to join the Lore Masters Guild, you can do so at patreon.com/questforpower. There we have some side quest episodes for you to discover people, places, factions, and things hidden in European lore, dungeons that are not in the main quests, and you get a shout out welcoming you to the guild.
So, Scott, what have you been up to lately? We haven't had a D&D session. We get one on this week, though, hopefully.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. If all goes well, we will continue our Dungeons & Dragons escapades.
You got it all set up in your head?
A little bit. There's some things where I just decide on how much I want to tie things in with other places in the world, or if it's just kind of an insulated, like, one-off thing.
Oh, gotcha. Gotcha.
So it's kind of that kind of colors a lot of it. But I know the theme, but this is going to be a lot of, like, last minute, just really jotting things down.
Okay.
Working well, things.
Those are some of the best sessions we've had, though, so that should be
fun. Yeah, yeah. Well, dungeons are a little different because you have to think about some of the implications of what you're doing, and sometimes you just don't, and you get some really great stuff. You also get some really bad stuff. Mm-hmm. I've done plenty of both. I think it just comes down to, and this kind of goes with pretty much, I think, anything in, like, game design, because I feel like that's what dungeon building especially is all about, is game design. And that's kind of like, what are you trying to incentivize, and is it fun? So it's like, okay,
yeah,
do I want...
That makes sense, yeah.
That's why, like, nowadays, most people who are doing dungeons nowadays don't just put traps in the middle of hallways without any warning whatsoever.
Yeah.
Or even if they have... Even if the answers are subtle, or maybe the players can suss it out with, like, a check, it's not very good for the flow of the dungeon, usually, because although it may make sense from a, like, design perspective... Like, if you were practically trying to stop people from entering, you would probably put something in that would just be very unexpected. But what happens is if you put a trap somewhere and it's completely out of the blue, players have no idea, then what it incentivizes them to do is all of a sudden stop and check everything.
Yeah,
and that's
exactly
not very fun. You're gonna half the players are gonna be checking stuff. Usually the people who are good at investigation or good perception, and then the other half of the party's bored. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's a balancing act. So I try and often fail to be a little more intentional with some of my design pieces, but
yeah,
kind of the fun challenge.
I think my character has the observe trait, so that'll be interesting to see what you just throw that wrench in your wheel.
Yeah. So, and that's the other part is, like, yeah, trying to find things that are engaging with players and their abilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Half the party's new. So that's the other part is I don't know what I'm designing for, and it's high level.
Yeah.
So things are very unpredictable. So,
yeah, it's either we sweep the floor or it's a TPK and it's pretty close.
We haven't had too much of that. It's
no,
thankfully, but it is definitely one of those things where it feels unforgiving at times. So,
yeah, that's true. All right. Well, let's get on to the main for everyone else that doesn't care about Dungeons and Dragons. I get it. before we dive into today's quest, we're going to go through our sources like usual. And per usual, it's the Merovingians. We're doing Gregory of Tours, like Childebert's brothers, all of his brothers episodes. Greg is writing based on other people's stories and notes. Childebert is one of the more religious brothers. I'm not sure it's saying much, but he's one of the more religious brothers, so I feel like Gregory goes a little easy on him, whereas some of the other ones, he kind of really digs in and tries to really show how wicked they are, so that'll be kind of interesting. And with that, DM, let's start today's session.
The Frankish kingdoms are at war. King Clovis of the Cilian Franks is still currently murdering anyone he considers family except his wives and children. I've heard this story before.
I know. The one thing I guess I will add is that I'm either right now or soon the kingdom will have converted to Christianity. It's not very clear from the sources what, like, children wise. I know it's after Clodomer, but that's about all I know is it's after him. Because it's like, Childebert's born in the same year Clovis converts, so kind of got that going for us. Anyway, before he is raised on a shield and takes the throne, we start our story in the Frankish city of Reims, where the Frankish queen consort Clotilda is giving birth to her third son with King Clovis. And the child is named Childebert. Clovis may have been near Clotilda during this birth. By near, I mean like in a different room. God forbid he'd be in the same room. That's a dirty room considered at this time because for some reason when women are given birth. So like the kid has to be get birthed, cleaned up, and then it can be presented to the king.
He's too good for that, apparently.
Yeah, it's just the way it goes. A lot of religion gets involved in that one. And then he's either that or he's still doing his favorite pastime of killing relatives. And then once he hears the birth, then he comes home. We don't know which one.
Yeah.
And then the record goes dark. We hear nothing about Childebert until Clovis dies for the fifth time now in our podcast. And this time, Childebert is made king of Paris, so we are following him this time. So, per usual, what previous kings are ruling while he is that we've covered while he's crowned? We have Theodoric the Great, and who is the reigning Ostrogothic king in Italy, and we have Thrasimund, who is the peaceful persecuting evil Arian Vandal king in Carthage, at least according to the Nicene Christians. And that is episode 13. If for some reason you want to hear about a peaceful persecuting story. All right. And with that, his reign begins. At some point in his reign, he will get married to a woman named Ultragotha. And this doesn't really help much. But based on her name, historians have figured out that it's a feminine name that's an East Germanic, and she's either an Ostrogoth, a Visigoth, a Burgundian, and she is most likely royalty. That's all we get from where she's from.
Well, we narrowed it down.
We did. They have two daughters, and that's all we know about their marriage. So say hi and bye to Ultragotha. God forbid we know anything else.
Record keeping.
Yeah, I can't wait till we get better sources. It's gonna be a while though.
Yeah, this feels like a long way.
Long way out.
Yeah.
This is a really good time in sources. We actually will, I think, have a dark age pretty soon, towards the end of the Merovingian reign after we no longer have Greg. So I should be thankful for him.
Because they killed everybody. That's probably why there is nobody there to record stuff. They killed them all.
Well, they tend not to kill the clergy who write things down, but yeah.
Tend not to. They just strike fear in the heart of the rest of them.
I mean that, yeah, they make definitely
sure they know
do
their
that.
Place.
That they definitely do. They have zero problems with that. Childebert's kingdom consists the northwest of France, except for Brittany. Fun fact, that's where like the Britons are, where King Arthur could have been from instead of England is another theory. So that's kind of interesting. That is, those Britons are the ones that will go to England, though.
Yeah, yeah.
That area is not under Frankish control. They tried and they failed. And then he also gets the area around Normandy, France, which is separated from his other domains. Oh, sorry. Normandy is part of his main one. Separate, he owns a part of Bordeaux, France, that is south of the Loire River, and it's right near Spain. It's like off the Atlantic. It's not really off the Atlantic coast. It's off whatever that sea is there by that, I don't know, that U-shaped coast. I don't know what. Do you get where I'm talking about?
A little bit, but it's at the, I'm having difficulty just picturing the map in my mind right now.
Okay, it's the bottom of France. It's like the south, we'll just say southwest of France is basically it. Oh, it's off the Bay of Biscay.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, you see where Bordeaux is? Okay, so it's south. Yeah, it's southwest of France by Bordeaux, and it's right off the Bay of Biscay, and he kind of owns all the land around that area. For those looking at a map.
Sounds like a sea. I'm like, you mean like the Atlantic?
Yeah, I know. No, it's a bay.
This is much better. Okay.
There we go. All right, corrected. Like Clodomer in our previous episode, we know nothing that happened in his rule until about 13 years later in 524. As I'm researching Clotaire's episode, I think it's just because the Clovis's sons are like really too young yet, and they're not like in their full, you know, power, so to speak. I think they might still be under the thumb of Clotilda for a little bit during this time, and that's why we hear nothing about them, because they're not encouraged to do anything. They're just like building up their power, I guess.
Okay.
Well, Childebert was part of his mother's Avengers alliance, we'll call them, against the Burgundian King Gundobad's son, Sigismund, in 524. Remember, Gundobad is the accomplice. Oh, sorry. Yeah, remember, Gundobad is the not the accomplice. Gundobad killed his mother's family when she was young, and now they're getting revenge.
Down the well.
Yep.
Down the well.
Exactly. There you go. And then Childebert is an accomplice. He's not the leader. That would be Clodomer to the murder of Saint Sigismund and his family. The entire family was beheaded and tossed into a well. We went into detail of this little story last episode, number 31, if you want to check that out. The Avengers also took part in a battle at Verons, where his brother Clodomer was killed in the fighting on June 25th, 524. Again, same thing as last episode. Clodomer's children were placed under the protection of Childebert's mother, Queen Dowager Saint Clotilda. And this is when we start getting into the details a little bit. Childebert went, we should not let tragedies go to waste like any good politician. And according to Gregory of Tours, Childebert sent a letter to his brother Clotaire, his youngest brother, and said, our mother has defenseless nephews. You should come to my palace and we should discuss what can be done with them. And Clotaire was ecstatic. He said, yep, I'll be right there.
It's a trap. Don't do it. It's a trap. I'm shouting at the TV right now.
Yep. The Childebert went to work immediately. This is when, you know, this is when you get someone who's really good at plots and manipulation. He began spreading the news that the kings, he and his brother, were meeting for the purpose of raising their young nephews to become kings. I'm guessing they're like, hey, well, we're trying to figure out, you know, all the ceremonies and things like that. We're trying to figure it all out, what the land should be. And he's kind of spreading those rumors around, so no one is any of the wiser. Because otherwise you go, why is he, you know, with you? Yeah. What are you guys planning?
Yeah, what are you two plotting?
And it wasn't long till Kildapert received news from a messenger. Hey, his brother has arrived. And the two brothers clasped hands, I'm guessing, gave a warm welcome. And he, after letting him get situated, the two met alone and began plotting, guessing over many cups of wine. And in their plotting, they came to a decision that, you know what? We're going to be nice about this. We will let our nephews either cut their hair or cut their life. And then we'll take Clodomer's lands either way. Because that's what we really want. We don't really care about what happens to them. So they're being merciful, Scott.
Yeah, that's what they call it, huh? Mercy?
Yeah. The two kings played up this facade for a while, and all the while they're making public plans of showing off, okay, we're ready to hand off Clodomer's kingdom. And yet at the same time, while they're showing that off, they actually are negotiating between the two of them how they're going to, you know, split up the kingdom and the treasury. Oh, and, you know, who gets his wife? Actually, I think that was made up already. I think that was already made up. I think Clotaire already got that because maybe Kildebert was already married and he didn't want another one. I don't know.
Oh, okay.
But eventually, they sent messengers over to their mother saying, hey, you should send our nephews over and then we can raise them to the throne. And Clotilda was ecstatic. She's like, wow, you know, I may have lost a son, but at least, you know, my nephews will carry on his tradition. And so she sent the two boys and to the palace, and then she kind of followed right behind. Immediately, once the nephews arrived, they were seized and dragged over to the two kings. They were cut off from basically all of their household. And then after a while, the two kings asked for their mother's presence. And when she arrived, her own two children demanded that she cut the prince's hair. And then that way she is the one depriving them of their royalty. And it's, you know, it's not on them. What a thing to do to your own mother.
Yeah. And she was just like, where did I go wrong?
That's psychological torture.
Yeah.
That is brutal.
Like, Clovis really, had the stronger genes in this scenario, I think.
My goodness. Yeah, they really took after their father.
Inherited his ruthlessness.
Yeah. She looked at them with disbelief and said, I raised these boys to be kings. Fuck off. Clotaire looked at his mother's dead in the eyes and went, so be it. And he grabs the oldest child named Theodobald, who is only 10 years old, by the arm and plunges a dagger into his armpit. And as the boy dies without mercy, he lets the boy fall limp and to the floor, gurgling his last breaths. As you can imagine, the other boy, Gunther, who's only 7 years old, immediately threw himself to his other uncle and begged for mercy. He's seven, and he just saw his brother get murdered in front of him, and pretty sure that's what's going to happen to him.
Yeah, that stands to reason.
And yeah, so hearing the screams of the oldest child, Kildebert got cold feet. Turns out murdering your nephews in cold blood for their kingdom is pretty disgusting when you think, you know, I don't know, 2 seconds about it.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's kind of a poor time to have his morals come back to him for a second.
Yeah. Kind of is when blood is already on your hands. Almost literally. I'm sure it probably literally. They're probably close enough. So tears are streaming down his face, and he turns to his bloodthirsty brother and basically says, let him live. Please let him live. I will pay a king's ransom for his life. And Clotaire, his youngest brother, stares at him with an icy cold stare and says, whoa. This whole thing was your idea. Are you that pathetic that you cannot follow through? If that's the case, you can die in his stead. Remember, the whole time Clotilda is there. an unimaginable psychological torture watching this whole thing unfold and helpless to do anything. Kildebert decides that he would rather live, so he grabs the other son, grabs his dagger, and cuts the child's throat, and then lets him fall right next to the traumatized Clotilda, who I doubt will ever look at her sons the same way again. And Kildebert must have not had too bad of cold feet, because he and Clotaire then massacred the children's household. Their defenseless servants and tutors were soon laying in a pool of their own blood. So, based on this whole story is all from Gregory, but I'm calling bullshit on the fact that Kildebert had cold feet. I think that he is trying to paint Clotaire as a much more evil individual than Kildebert in this situation. And again, I think it's because Clotaire is against the church. He does not give a fuck about the church, but Kildebert is the more religious of the brothers. So maybe he's trying to soften that blow. Yeah. And there's some things that happen later on in Kildebert's reign that also make me think this.
Yeah, or he just wants to tell a good story.
That too. I mean, he does like to weave a good story.
Yeah, yeah.
The two princes' brother, Clotald, managed to escape. He must not have been with them at the time. He cut his own hair, and like I'll just cut it myself, and he became venerated as Saint Cloud. The Merovingian kings then split up Clodomir's kingdom, annexing parts of it to their own domain along with his treasury. Clodomir received Clotaire received Clodomir's wife as his first wife, and we'll go into detail on that next episode. However, back to this one. One day around 531, a courier came up to him and said, "I've got something to deliver, your hands only." He hands him a package which contains a bloody handkerchief and a letter from his sister Clotilda, who is currently married to Amalaric, king of the Visigoths. Remember, they did this marriage, Clovis and Clotilda did this marriage to kind of create peace between the two nations.
Yeah, you mean one that didn't last?
Yeah, pretty much. And in the letter, she writes that she is being abused because of her beliefs as a Chalcedonian Christian, also a Nicene Christian, in an evil Arian Christian court. And this handkerchief is proof of her mistreatment. So immediately he sets out with his war band. He invades Visigothic Spain. He chases Amalaric into Barcelona, which is, if people don't know, that is in the, I want to say, northeast-ish of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
While in Barcelona, Amalaric gives a visit from a child of the night is an assassinated. Basically, Kildebert paid someone to take him out there. And Kildebert loads up with loot and he heads back home. So basically, he went on a raid to grab his sister and come back home, kill the king, and come back. Unfortunately, his sister Clotilda didn't make it back to Paris alive, and she perishes sometime along the way. Her body is placed alongside her father Clovis. So Clotilda buries both her husband and her daughter. So something doesn't add up here. His sister somehow managed to sneak a letter with a blood-stained handkerchief in a letter basically that says, "Come rescue me," and no one found out.
Yeah, it's just one of those it's one of those things that I feel like is just, we have a lot of stories that are made up or probably fabricated for the sake of being able to justify an invasion.
Yeah, it has to be, because why else? Because if that was the case, wouldn't his brothers all join him? They do everything together anyway right now.
Yeah.
They kill family members together. Like,
plus, like, I mean, the handkerchief. How much proof are you really? How much proof are you really going to get out of a handkerchief?
Exactly. Yeah. Like, it's not like they have DNA. They can't test her blood.
You know? Yeah, they don't know whose blood it is. They also don't know where it came from. Or because, like, you could just like prick your finger, right?
Exactly.
And yeah, like, hey, look at that! Got blood on this handkerchief.
Or you just stab a servant.
Or an animal.
Or an animal. Or
make something like that looks like blood. I mean, I don't know. There's probably something.
Yeah, it's not hard. I'm guessing this is all a pretext to war. And I'm guessing that he needed his sister silenced, and so he had her killed. I'm guessing.
Oh.
Because it's very convenient to me that she doesn't make it back, and this is the story he goes with, because she could flat out deny it. Maybe she didn't want, you know, her husband to be killed.
Yeah. Well,
we have no
water under the bridge.
It is. So that's another reason why I said I think maybe he didn't have cold feet. That was the other thing I was thinking about.
He was just filled with so much religious passion.
Yes.
He marched over there just to go teach those dirty, dirty Aryans a lesson.
Exactly. You hit it right on the head. How dare we think otherwise? So remember, during this time, there's still a war going on between the Merovingian kings and the Burgundian king Godomar. I'm pretty sure it's a cold war. I'm pretty sure no battles are going on, because some sources call it the first war and the second war. But there was never any, like, peace agreement in between then. So I'm guessing that, you know, there were skirmishes back and forth. But we don't hear anything about this conflict until 532, when the Merovingians besiege Godomar and his forces in the Burgundian city Autun in 532. And around this time, fun fact, it's probably called Augustonium after the Roman Empire's first emperor, Augustus. So there you go. Fun fact, if you didn't know that. We know nothing about the siege, per usual, except for Godomar and his forces are decisively defeated. Godomar completely disappears from the record. Not even speculation from sources that he died in battle. No mention of his body. Even the sources are like, yeah, he just disappeared. We know nothing. Went MIA. It took another 2 years to go by until all of Burgundy was pacified. And by pacified, I mean they put down all the rebellions and killed anyone that tried to put up any type of resistance. And then in Merovingian fashion, each king took an equal share of the spoils of war and everything that it entailed.
All right.
So there you go. Burgundy now has been split up.
Easy money.
Exactly. In 534, you'll recall, maybe not, but Clovis's eldest son, Theuderic, died, which meant it left his son, Theudebert, exposed. And Childebert and Clothar, got together, and you're like, you know, let's do this again. We did it to two nephews. We can do it again. However, it became very clear, very fast, that Childebert was not to be messed with, and both brothers backed away and went, my bad, I'm sorry, I didn't mean it, I swear. And since Childebert didn't have any legitimate sons, after this little showdown, Childebert formally adopted Theudebert as his son and heir, probably so Theudebert doesn't get any ideas about retaliation of, you know, trying to kill him thing. However, something broke down in diplomacy around 537 between Childebert and Clotair, because in that year, Childebert, now allied with Theudebert, and went against his brother Clotair, who he's been allying with all the way up to this point. So, you know, typical Merovingian, not just that, just Dark Ages fashion, alliances switching back and forth.
Yeah, per the norm.
So both sides marshal their forces on the battlefield. For the first time that I think I can recall in Merovingian history, of Clovis's line, brother is going against brother in an actual battle. This is personal. It was going to change.
Is it storm time?
There you go.
Is it time for the storm?
Yes, you are correct. You recall, yes. As you recall in the previous episodes, way off in the distance, their mother, Clotilda, was praying and praying despite her children, you know, doing one of the most horrific acts in front of her. They still had their mother's love, and she did not want any more bloodshed in her family. And she pled with God, please don't let them kill each other. And as a result, the heavens literally opened up, dark worlds rolled in, and you called it. Lightning storms went, terrible downpour, whipping wind around the battlefield. Armies were useless, can't do anything, and this forced her sons to come to some sort of peace agreement, which they oddly abided by the rest of their lives.
Well, I could say her forgiveness is very saintly behavior.
There you go. Got to get your puns in.
Well, I mean, that one's probably just a little on the nose.
It is.
Literally.
It is.
Yeah.
So despite trying to end his brother's existence a little bit, he allies himself again with Clotaire, and together they capture Pamplona, Spain, from the Visigoths. Pamplona is a city just past the Pyrenees Mountains between France and Spain. And, you know, boosted confidence after taking Pamplona felt pretty easy. So they're like, all right, we're going to march our forces south to Zaragoza, and they put that city under siege. Visigoths seem to be, you know, like a pretty easy force to keep killing right now.
The Visigoths are to the Merovingians as the Suevi are to the Visigoths.
I like it. Yep.
Easy target. Beat them up. Get some street cred.
Yeah.
Go back home victorious.
Yeah. Except this time they were forced to lift the siege. I could not find why. Maybe when we do the Visigoths, we'll figure out why.
Dysentery.
Possible. I mean, that's already happened, so that's wouldn't be far off. But all was not lost, and this is why he is considered the more religious one. In the melee, he managed to loot the stole of Saint Vincent from the evil heretical Arians.
Good for him.
You probably
don't know what that is.
You probably have never heard of St. Vincent. It is not St. Vincent de Paul, which is a pretty famous one. He's just a saint over in Spain. He had the unfortunate luck to be a Spanish deacon during the reign of Roman Emperor Diocletian. He was martyred by being tortured and then burned in 304 during the infamous Christian persecution of Diocletian. Diocletian is one of the main names that comes up when it comes to Romans persecuting the Christians. So, checks out.
All right.
So, as a result of acquiring the sacred relic, he was inspired. And in 543, he founded a church in honor of Saint Vincent, and he stored the holy relic there. And what was believed to be a piece of wood that Jesus Christ died on. I only got that from one source, and I'm not sure I believe that.
Yeah.
But that was one
big
source.
Big asterisk.
Yeah. What is for sure is the church is still around today, and it is known as the Abbey de Saint-Germain-des-Prés, and it's right in Paris, or Paris in French. At least I think that's how you say it in French.
To my knowledge, yeah.
And then in June of 545, he received a letter which read that his mother Clotilda had died of natural causes. So he and his brother Clotaire were pallbearers in her funeral procession, and she was buried next to Clovis and their daughter Clotilda.
So that they could let her down one last time.
Oh, nice. Yes.
That is classic. It's a classic joke.
It is classic. Yep. Oh, perfect.
It fit too well.
It did. It really did. Childebert chose the date of December 23rd, 558, for the dedication of the church he founded as the Basilica of St. Vincent and the Holy Cross. However, also on that same very day, on December 23rd, 558, a day before Christmas Eve, Childebert died. We don't know why, probably being 60, and he's in around 60 years, and living during medieval times.
That'll do it to you.
It's kind of, you know, poetic that, you know, the date that his church is dedicated. The sources were very clear that they said, despite the king dying on that day, they went ahead with the dedication anyway for the church.
Well, you know, we got to open up this bad boy for business.
Yeah, exactly. Got to start collecting those dues.
Yeah, well, it's not like the king's going anywhere.
Yeah, exactly. He really wasn't going anywhere. He had no male heirs. His kingdom was annexed by the last son of Clovis standing, and that is Clotaire the First, without bloodshed. The Frankish kingdoms are once again united under one king. That's all I got for Childebert. Are you ready to rate him?
Yep, let's do it. Royal power.
So he acquired power by butchering his nephews and their household. His record against Burgundy is, with his alliance, is 2 victories to 1 defeat. Ironically, because of that defeat, he ends up, you know, taking his brother's lands, and later he will become king of Burgundy, so he really wins in the end. Against the Visigoth sieges wise, he captures one, loses one. So, but he got really good loot from the quest. And he got schooled by his nephew, you know, and was forced to back down. He wanted to take his land like his other nephews, but he showed him up. So some good, some bad.
Yeah. This feels like an overall win.
Oh, definitely.
So we'll give it a 7 out of 10.
I'd agree. Yep, that's exactly what I was thinking.
A medium 7 and a 7 for 14. All right, infamy.
All right, so for aggravating factors, obviously, the murder of Clodomer's sons is one of the most infamous acts of history during this time. There is artwork made of this depicting this scene. And according to Gregory, he also successfully assassinated the Visigothic king Amalaric. And typically kings don't assassinate each other, that because, you know, they don't want it to happen to them. And this is pretty seen as a pretty evil act. So versus just killing, you know, honorably through combat.
Yeah.
Pretty high on this one. I mean, I can't stress enough. We've talked about the murders how many times now? Four?
Yeah, a few times. Yeah,
I think this is the fourth or fifth. No, this is the fifth time. Clotilda, so. Teuderic. Yeah. The fourth time. Teuderic, fourth. Clodomer, yeah, this is the fourth time. Pretty infamous act. So what are you thinking for that one?
Give it a nice big whopping 8.
Yep, I agree.
Feels like pretty infamous.
Yeah, very infamous.
Pretty infamous, and honestly, just the fact that we get plenty of record in some fashion, either fictitious or otherwise. It's pretty nice.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, he's breaking the mold. Not always in a good way. Mostly not in a good way. All right. So we have a 8 and an 8 for 16. Religious passion.
He gained control of an important holy relic. It's like finding a really good item, quest item for your deity. He built a basilica based on that relic, and it's still around today. The still around today, I don't know if we give that legacy or if that is part of religious passion.
It's kind of both.
It is. We'll give it for both. But the fact that, you know, I think this one is a little bit more. Getting relics is pretty important in this time. As we've kind of discussed in past, it's like you're getting a fast pass to God's word. You know, God's help.
Yeah. Another hand has touched the beacon.
Exactly. Listen.
So, for this, he built a church too, which is nice. That's a nice thing. Because I think to me,
not just that, an abbey, not just a church, not just like a church, an abbey. So, a pretty sizable one.
So, yeah, because I think, my opinion, I say anyone can come across a relic, give or take, right? You're on a battle. It's like, look at that. You got a nice shiny pebble, lucky penny.
There are a lot of relics this time.
They have a Dorito that has the pattern that looks like Jesus Christ's face was imprinted on one side.
That's right.
So, but you know what? He did something with it. He didn't just destroy it or put it in his pocket and use it to... as a keychain for his house keys. No, he built an abbey. So not a ton of, well, we don't know about any preaching or debating, but yeah, for this one, out of 10, this is like, to me, another like 8.
Wow.
Feels high, but like, I don't know. Building churches probably did more. Feels like, yeah, I don't know.
Oh, and he went after the Aryans. But he didn't say that was the reason.
Questionable. Yeah. Had a multitude of reasons, but Arianism was not one of them.
Well, it kind of was, because his sister was being beaten because of her faith. So, kind of.
Yeah.
I was originally thinking 5, but you're pushing me up to...
Relics are important. Yeah. Anyways.
I'll give a 6.
All right. 8 and a 6 for 14. Ability.
So positive. Just in general, not having a male heir is not positive. His entire reign, he doesn't have a male heir. Any kind of history will tell you when there's no male heir, there's instability in the kingdom, there's civil war right around the corner. Also, civil war with your brother, that's going to create some instability. And then also getting schooled by your nephew and you have to back down and, you know, adopt that nephew, that's going to show some weakness. There's some more instability that'll show under the cracks.
Yeah, it's the whole no male heir thing is a pretty big downgrade. Not downgrade. Yeah, sure. Bad marks. it just makes me think about like the especially a lot of people get the classic like, oh, when are you having kids, right? Imagine how stressful that's gotta be for them.
Yeah. Yep.
Like a lot of people feel it today.
Yeah,
imagine what it was like back then.
It's a life. It's a harrowing, death-defying experience for the woman, and it's life or death sometimes for thousands of people on a kingdom. Like
no pressure. Nope. Yeah.
Just because a son is born, most of the time there's a civil war. So.
So, no pressure. All right. So, for stability, feels like kind of not that great. But you know what? Things kind of turn out all right in the end. He dies peacefully. Give him like a 2.
I agree, 2.
2 out of 5. 2 and a 2 for 4. Royal demise.
He died on the same day his basilica was being consecrated. It's kind of poetic.
Oh, that's fun. Yeah, I do. I am a fan of poetic justice in a story.
He
smiled with he died with a smile on his face, knowing that his life's work was complete.
Yeah.
It's a solid one for me.
Good storybook ending.
Yeah. The end.
All right. How much are you thinking? One.
One and one for two. Legacy.
So dynasty wise, we'll go over what happens to his wife and daughters, two daughters, next episode, but essentially his bloodline vanishes because he has no sons. His kingdom collapses and is subsumed into his brothers. The basilica is still here today, as I've discovered. Also, the church, the basilica he founds, will actually be the royal necropolis for Neustrian kings that will be buried there until 675. So, as you can imagine, despite, you know, France being united, it's going to break apart again. And every time there's Neustrian kings, they're going to be buried there for quite a while. So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. What? Yeah, like 100 years or so. Yeah,
about 100 years. Yeah. A lot of kings in that time.
Yeah. Yeah. So, honestly, the whole like kingdom getting absorbed back feels kind of somewhat, because things are shifting so rapidly between one king to the next.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the identity because it's not like, I can't imagine the identity of the folks underneath that kingdom being too radically different, right?
Oh yeah,
like, no. Like, you know, these are just folks doing their thing. Like, the fact that one gets absorbed into the other feels like it, their legacy, that doesn't impact their legacy a ton. No.
So, it basically affects,
but he has some infamy too.
Yeah, it basically affects the nobility, the high clergy, so nobility, but anyone lower than that, it doesn't really affect. I can't imagine, besides wars. That's the only thing that would affect them.
Yeah. Like, that's what I'm saying is like that. You know, the folks in the realm would probably consider themselves its one relative-ish identity if they have one. Like, national identity isn't really formed.
Yeah, know? No. Oh, no.
But like,
not the way we
but there is like, it. Yeah, but like, there is some level of like, yeah, I'm like from this area, right?
Correct, yeah.
You'd think.
But it's usually, I am from this town.
Yeah, okay. Anyways, so for legacy, also because he does like pretty infamous thing, kind of seems to carry. He has artwork on him for it. Yeah,
that is true. He does leave behind some artwork for that.
So, I feel like this is, let's see, out of 10. Tough, but I'm willing to give out like a 5 here.
Yeah, I would have given him like a 7 had the kingdom not completely collapsed because of, you know, the royal necropolis. Pretty huge. That's pretty, you know, that's pretty legacy right there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yeah, like you said, the killing of that story alone, pretty big legacy.
Oh, know his name.
But losing your kingdom and having no legacy, like bloodline after that, it's going to take huge points. I'm going to wax 5 points off of that, so we'll do 2 points.
All right, 5 and a 2 for 7. So, all right, it's total time.
All right, let's give the rundown. What did he do?
Jack. No. So, royal power. Total of 14.
Pretty decent.
Infamy. Total of 16. Religious passion. A nice 14. So like pretty good so far.
Yeah.
Does all right.
Pretty solid.
Stability. Big four. Royal Demise. Two. Legacy is a seven. And then finally, your grand total out of 100, 57.
That's not terrible. That's pretty
good. It's not too bad.
It's not too bad. Well,
yeah.
With that 57, Scott, does he have the epicness to be crowned as High King in the Hall of Legends? Or is he just good enough to be a minor king in the Hall of Mediocrity? Or is he so bad that we should just burn him at the stake?
He's in the mediocrity.
I think so too. I think we really gave too much credit to Teodoric. Cause
to
this
the
guy,
bell curve with you.
Because this guy did more than Teodoric, I think, did. But yeah. He just doesn't scream High King to me.
No. Well, because he didn't really he did stuff. It's not like he claims vast swaths of land. He kind of just consolidated power, which is nice. It's really nice.
Yeah.
He consolidated it selflessly because he ended up dying and kindly donating it all to his brother posthumously.
Yeah, his brother gets his hand-me-downs.
So, yeah. In the long run, it's pretty good. Probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Until it breaks apart all over again.
Yeah.
Until people learn that maybe, just maybe, we shouldn't be dividing the kingdom up by our heirs.
You know, growing up, I never thought I'd be so pro primogeniture when you read about the stories and stuff, but I'm so pro primogeniture in terms of kingdoms. And if you're already doing a not fair, government.
I don't know. This one seems pretty fair for the kids involved.
Oh, it does. Yeah. Very, very fair. And sets them up for a life of violence.
Well, yeah. We said fair, not peaceful.
That is true. Well, you got anything else on him?
I have to say that, once again, we're kind of getting more pieces to the puzzle. Because, like we said, this is like the fourth time we talked about the murders of these nephews.
Yep.
We getting a little more of the family tree.
Yeah.
Reasonably competent guy, but just once again fell a little short of the mark.
It's kind of nice we're getting kings that are competent, even though they fall a little short, unlike when we had the Visigoths and the Vandals, where you had the one great king and they were all disasters afterward. You know, like Clovis is the one great king, and yet we had pretty mediocre, but they did a good enough job afterward.
Yeah, it's also nice to not have like the old man in warrior society.
Oh god, the Vandals, yeah.
So, all in all, pretty good, all things considered.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, that brings us to the end of Childebert the First. Let us know what you thought of him. Do you agree with us on placing him in the Hall of Mediocrity? You can catch us on Messenger on Facebook and Instagram at Quest for Power, or email us at questforpowerpod@gmail.com. If you enjoyed our podcast, please give us a 5-star review on podchaser.com or wherever you get your podcasts. If you tell a friend or family member, that also is hugely appreciated, just to get us out there. We already are seeing growing numbers, so thank you very much, everyone, for listening to us. We appreciate it. If you want some extra content from us and want to join the Lore Masters Guild and go on side quest adventures with us, you can do so at patreon.com/questforpower. And that is all we have for this session. Next session, we are going to review the mighty Clotaire the First, who we have heard about for many episodes now. And finally, with that, the king is dead.
Long live the king!